This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. We're spending the next hour with two people who are keeping very different pieces of culture alive. Folk musician Derek Peter has put together a cultural archive that's available online. But we begin with the keeper of the memory of a curious mega arena that no longer stands. Its official name was the New Haven Veterans Memorial Coliseum. It was downtown on Orange Street, across the way from the Knights of Columbus building, looming in view for anyone driving through the intersection of I-95, 91, and Route 34 in New Haven. It could seat more than 11,000 fans for concerts, Bruce Springsteen, Aerosmith, Elvis, to name just a few. There were monster truck pulls, WWE Smackdowns, hockey games, and many, many other events. And for 30 years, it was a cultural center of sorts for the area. And it was a hockey game that was the very first event held at the Coliseum 50 years ago this month. It was demolished in 2007, but its memory and its legacy have been preserved by Richard Henley. He's a professor of journalism and co-director of sports studies at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. And later this month, he'll present a virtual lecture with the New Haven Museum. It's called New Haven Coliseum, Where Boomers Roamed. And right now he joins us via Zoom. Professor Henley, welcome back to The Full Story.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here again.
I must admit, I was a boomer roamer at the Coliseum back in the day. Construction started in 1968. What was the impetus? Why was it built? Why was it built where it was put up as well?
This was the capstone to Mayor Richard C. Lee's urban revitalization of New Haven. He had torn down a great deal of neighborhoods in New Haven, by Route 34. He put up the Chapel Square Mall, put up Knights of Columbus, put up several other edifices as a way to renew New Haven and make it relevant to suburban families who had lived in New Haven but fled after World War II. And this was the Coliseum was a plan to get people back to New Haven for basic middle class entertainment, concerts, hockey games, circuses, and the like. And the problem was that there really wasn't a lot of room in New Haven for a building of this size. And there was not any room whatsoever for a parking lot to hold 2,400 cars.
Yeah, the design was unusual, right? The parking lot was sort of on top of the arena, as I recall?
That was architect Kevin Roach's solution, which he drew from Cobo Hall in Detroit, which had a parking lot on top of Cobo Hall, which was a similar facility. Because there was no real land around the Coliseum for a surface lot, or even a multi-layered decked lot, he decided that, well, we're going to have to put it on the roof. The thing is, you couldn't dig down into the ground of the Coliseum because the water table was really high. That was all reclaimed land from Long War. So they had no choice. They had to put it on the roof, and they did, and that started a cascade of problems that ultimately led to its demise.
I do recall, regarding what you just said, that was it the salt and water from cars parking in the lot over the years, having brought up what was left from the spray during winter and whatnot, that penetrated the concrete, got into the steel. I do recall there being large nets hanging underneath some of the parking, part of that parking area over a road that went underneath. It began to sort of crumble, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It started to rust and crumble pretty quickly. The concrete would spall, and that would leave gaps in the concrete garage where salt would leach into from cars carrying it off the interstates, to see shows and whatnot. So that got inside. That then rusted the rebar. Rebar wasn't treated at the time when it was built in the late 60s, early 70s. So the rebar got rusted, and that caused the concrete to crack even more, which opened up more room for water and salt to get in, compounding the problem. And then what happened by the mid-80s, shards of concrete started to fall off. And that presented a danger to the passersby below the deck of the Coliseum and caused the Coliseum authorities to place safety netting underneath the decks, and that wasn't a very attractive or appealing sight.
Was the original design for the structure actually completed? I understand that not everything was finished, at least as was originally intended.
No, the Colosseum Authority ran out of money. If you look at the original design, it's quite a handsome building, you know, with the garage enclosed by translucent panels, an exhibition hall enclosed by glass out front. So it was a quite appealing looking building coming off the highway. You'd see this glass enclosure for various boat shows and auto shows and whatnot, with the translucent panels wrapped around the parking garage on top. But the city ran out of money and just said, screw it. Okay, off goes the exhibition hall, off goes the translucent panels. And so the building was never finished. It never looked like it was finished. And it, you know, and it operated in a way that you know, made it quite unattractive. You know, this they used a steel called cordon steel, which strengthens as it rusts. So it was looked like a rusted hulk that had washed up on the shore.
It did look like a building, as I recall, that would prompt one to ask, what exactly is that? What's it for? It didn't look like a venue, certainly, for the many, many events that it played host to over the years. And despite that being incomplete or not finished, did it successfully hold the many events that the city hoped would come?
You know, it did. I mean, it did hold, you know, a lot of concerts. I mean, it was part of the New England concert tour that national acts would pursue. So they'd play New Haven, then they'd play Hartford, then they'd play Springfield, then they'd play Providence, then they'd play Worcester, then they'd play Portland. All these buildings were constructed around the same time. And rock acts in particular would tour all these buildings and sell out these venues. So, yeah, it did certainly host its fair share of concerts. Some of the greatest rock acts of the time appeared there. One of its downfalls, however, happened to be by accident. When the Parfitt Civic Center's roof collapsed, The building was rebuilt with a larger capacity. And that meant you can get 15,000 people in there instead of 10,000 at the Colosseum. So rock acts would go for the 5,000 extra seats because that meant more revenue. So more acts like Springsteen would no longer play the Coliseum. He was a mainstay in the 70s. But by the 80s, when the Hartford Civic Center reopened, he would play the Civic Center because he could sell 5,000 more tickets.
I do recall early on seeing James Taylor at the Coliseum and also Deep Purple, early 70s, with an opening act called Tucky Buzzard. I don't think they lasted too long. But other than concerts and hockey games, I recall going to see the New Haven Nighthawks at the Coliseum in New Haven. Other than the concerts and hockey games, it did play host to other events, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you have monster truck pulls. The circus was an annual attraction in town. Ice Capades, Ice Follies. Just about any event that could be held indoors took place there. So you had tennis was played there, but some of the great stars of tennis showed up to play some indoor matches. So just about any event that could be held indoors was held indoors there. Of course, there was the annual boat show, the auto show, the home show, stuff like that went on there each year. And as a result, you know, a lot of people went through those doors. You know, many, many tens of thousands went through those doors over the years. And as such, you know, it became part of the collective memory of folks in the region. It became part of their childhood, became part of their young adulthood. And then, you know, by the time they became adults and had children, they would take their children to the circus, to the hockey game, etc. So the building had an intergenerational component to it that is often overlooked.
You said that the Coliseum is both a failure and a success, which pretty much defines the nature of the baby boom generation. Can you elaborate on that a bit more?
Sure. It had some wins. I mean, it became the home office for baby boomers. It's where baby boomers gathered with their friends, you know, to see rock shows, Grateful Dead, etc. Gather, you know, in the parking lot to exchange stories and other things. that I don't need to mention here, like people can use their imagination for. People would actually create a culture of waiting in line for tickets, where if you had to go to the bathroom, folks would watch your stuff. So there was an element of trust there while you went to the bathroom and, you know, came back and your line in the for tickets would be preserved. But then, of course, tickets became computerized, the lines disappeared, and that part of the culture went along with it. So it was a success in that a lot of people lived a lot of their adolescent and young adult lives there in terms of the consuming culture. On the failure side, I mean, the building just failed. It just cost a lot of money to maintain. When the concrete decks needed to be repaired, it cost the same as much as it took to build the building, $23 million. And then it became a question of whether it was worth it. And also, time had passed the baby boomers. The era of the mega concert tours was coming to an end. There weren't as many bands that could sell out the building. So the building just kind of stood there. And to me, one of the most interesting elements that I unearthed during the research was a letter the architect Kevin Roach wrote in the mid-1960s when planning first opened on the building. He said the building would fail because it was in a dead zone. He said, yeah, they may be busy 100 times a year with 40 hockey games, 40 concerts, and 20 other things. But for the other 265 days, it would be dark. So the city really needed to consider building an entertainment district around the Coliseum to keep it lively year round. And that never took place. So for most of the year, the building was dark, unlit, and it just sat there as, quite frankly, an eyesore at the gates to the city. And that didn't do anything for the city's reputation. And then, of course, it became, you know, a pawn in the debate about what to put there if you tear it down. Should it be a mall, which would have been a disaster if they did that? You know, should it be a parking lot for the train station, which is what they ultimately did, a surface lot? Or what should you do with that property? It wasn't that large a piece of property. So it failed in that respect. And there have been, since the Coliseum closed in 2002, a number of plans to revitalize that district, none of which have come to fruition.
The events that were held at the Coliseum, were they always held with the suburban audience in mind? Did the events benefit at all, attract at all the neighborhoods in the city itself?
Well, certainly some folks who lived in New Haven were able to walk over to the Coliseum, but New Haven wasn't like it is now with a lot of apartments in downtown. Folks might have come over from Westville, East Rock, The Hill, you know, et cetera, and to see a show. But for the most part, it was built for suburbanites. And one of the interesting ironies of it all is that it was possible to drive into New Haven, drive up the Helix to the garage, park into the garage, take the escalator down to the concourse level entry, see your event, get back on the escalator, get back in your car, and never once physically set foot on city ground. So it sort of defeated its purpose to attract city goers back to the city, because they would see a show and they would leave.
Talking to Professor Richard Hanley about the New Haven Coliseum, the Veterans Memorial Coliseum, about its history. I was going to ask you if you had gone to the Coliseum many times yourself, but based on that very detailed description of parking, getting down to the concourse level, seeing the event, and then getting back in the car and driving out, you clearly have been there a few times yourself.
Oh, yeah. I saw a number of concerts there. I actually played high school hockey there. I went to Platt High School in Meriden, and we played the New Haven High Schools at the Coliseum many times over the years. That was their home ice when the arena closed. That was always interesting, playing hockey in front of 10,000 empty seats on a Thursday afternoon. But one thing is that, and the hockey players I talked to ratified this, the ice at the Coliseum was quite exceptional. It was really, really good ice.
Quality Zamboni, I guess, huh?
Yeah, they had the Zamboni, the best Zamboni you could buy, I imagine. But the ice always held firm, and it was always a good surface to skate on.
You mentioned the sort of affection a lot of people have, the baby boomers primarily, for the venue. Is that unique to the Coliseum? Do you think younger generations or previous generations felt the same way about venues that they went to attend various kinds of events?
I think the younger people are younger or older than me when I was a little young at the time, but had the same feeling for the arena. But the arena really was kind of in the dumps.
That's by the old New Haven arena you're talking about, right?
Yeah, where the FBI headquarters is in New Haven now. Mm-hmm. By the 60s. It had seen better days. It needed to be refurbished. It didn't have the professional ice service or professional glass. It had what amounted to chicken wire surrounding the ice surface. But, you know, we all remember our youth fondly, so because we were young.
that kind of devotion to a venue, I mean, it reminds me of the kind of talk you hear about, for instance, Toad's Place in New Haven, still a venue. On Long Island, there was a venue called My Father's Place, which I think is still active, but not in the same location. Much smaller. There were clubs more than large venues, which, as you point out, became sort of the way to see a concert, the big concerts of the 70s and 80s, anyway.
I mean, the culture has changed. The way we consume culture has changed. Before the advent of the Hartford Healthcare Amphitheater in Bridgeport, Toyota Oakdale in Wallingford, Xfinity Center in Hartford, the Mohegan Sun, and whatnot. There are really only a couple of places to see a big show, and that would be the Coliseum or the Hartford Civic Center. Now there are a number of smaller venues, more intimate venues, and you get a lot of really good acts coming through for round three or round four of their careers, you know, like the Doobie Brothers circulating through, but in a more intimate setting, because you're not going to be able to sell 10,000, 15,000 seats. So Connecticut is well served by the Hartford Healthcare Amphitheater in Bridgeport, Oakdale, Toyota Oakdale in Wallingford, Mohegan Sun out in eastern Connecticut, and certainly Xfinity Theater up in Hartford. And they're right size to the moment. They can sell out. They can sell enough tickets. And then, of course, in downtown New Haven, College Street Music Hall, the Westville Music Bowl, they're right sized for the moment. It would be a catastrophic waste of money to open a building the size of the Coliseum right now, when there certainly wouldn't be any demand for seats for all but just a handful of acts.
Your interest, go ahead.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, hockey, which is covered in the documentary, hockey started out in New Haven as a college sport. And minor league hockey would be a tough sell now because of, Quinnipiac University, my employer, has an arena that opened the year the Coliseum was imploded, 2007. Yale Ingalls Rink is still packed for hockey. So there's plenty of good top-level college hockey that people can go to enjoy that sport in the region.
Your interest in the Coliseum, the old New Haven Coliseum, certainly goes well beyond the attention that most people who have fond memories have paid to it. You mentioned the documentary, I believe, released, in 2010, about the Coliseum. What brought you to that level of interest in the Coliseum?
Well, one thing that brought me to it, I wanted to see what the story was. I wasn't interested in producing a list of things that happened. In other words, I just didn't want to say this act played there, in a several-month period, Elvis played there, Bob Dylan played there, and Frank Sinatra played there in 1975. I wanted to find out what the story was. Like, why was it built this way? And why was it a publicly funded, middle-class venue for entertainment? This was really the first generation where the government got into middle-class entertainment. Before, arenas were privately owned and built with private dollars. This was really the first generation where tax dollars were used to build what amounted to middle-class edifices for entertainment. And this was an expansion of government services. I wanted to see what the thinking was. I have no animus toward that. I just wanted to see what the mayor was thinking, what city leaders were thinking. And as it turns out, they were thinking as it was a means to save the city, to get people back in. It just didn't work out the way they planned.
Is there something about the Coliseum that you'd like to share that you think most people don't know or would be surprised about?
Well, there's a quote from John Updike from a story he wrote in the New Yorker many years ago about architecture that I had remembered long before the Colosseum had closed. I just thought it was an interesting quote that I just kept in the recesses of my mind because I'm a fan of Updike. I like his writing. And he wrote that buildings have a function beyond the baldly utilitarian. And that was kind of like what I thought of the Colosseum. Yeah, you saw shows there, but it's really a human story where humans got together and shared a collective memory publicly. Now, of course, we're inside our phones or you're inside our digital devices, and we're kind of, our heads are down, poised to look what's flashing across our screens on social media. And there really is, although there's an appearance or an illusion of a public square on social media, it is not the physical public square which really binds people together. And to me, the Colosseum was a place that functioned beyond the baldly utilitarian as a public square where a generation got together and had shared experiences to see in a show, then later taking their kids to the circus. So it was kind of like the last place where a large number of people can share a singular experience at a singular moment in time and then share those memories over the years. So to me, it's a building that certainly outlived its usefulness, but it performed a role in bringing a public together for one moment in time to see a magical show, to see a memorable hockey game. And those moments, alas, are few and far between as we burrow deeper and deeper into our digital lives.
Rich Hanley is a professor of journalism and the co-director of sports studies at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. And I want to remind you that he'll be speaking at a free virtual presentation about the New Haven Coliseum in conjunction with the New Haven Museum. That'll be on Thursday, September 29th, 6 p.m. And you can find a link to register for the event on our website, wshu.org. Professor Hanley, thanks for sharing your insights and your memories of the New Haven Coliseum. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed our discussion.
Almost 2 years ago, New England-based folklorist, performer, and composer Derek Peter was a guest here on The Full Story, and we talked about his quest to find the Appalachian connection to a 500-year-old ballad. Well, since then, he's been quite busy, embarked on a new venture. It's called the Fieldwork Archive. It's an online archive of folk songs, poetry, memories, and interviews from pretty much all over the world. And Derek Peter joins us again to talk about this new work that he's been involved with. He's on Zoom. Good to have you back, Derek.
Thanks for having me back. Thanks for your interest.
Certainly. Please describe the Fieldwork Archive. What do we find when we go to the site?
Well, I just did a magazine piece for The Wire magazine, and I guess the byline has me described as a DIY folklorist, which is an idea that I'm still getting my head around, but that feels pretty apt for the listeners that maybe don't know what folklore is, or maybe have only seen it with the Taylor Swift album title, Folklore. Folklore is pretty much the study of what we kind of do as humans to get us through the end of our days. It was before radio, we had songs and stories and tales and sayings and superstitions that we would pass from generation to generation. Now, certainly the advent of radio and 7 inches and TV and iPads and TikTok and has really altered the way that we interface with our families and communities with oral tradition. But I was sort of on a mission to prove that it's still out there and to lightly defy all of the people that I've spoken with who do study folklore and have said to me, well, Alan Lomax was collecting 100 years ago. You can't do that sort of thing now. And I'm out to sort of gently say, yes, you can. So I began, as we spoke about 2 years ago, I had been doing research on some Appalachian ballads and had gotten in touch with a family member of a woman who had still remembered some of these old songs. And I went to meet her in this little town on the border of Tennessee and North Carolina, and she did remember and sing a lot of songs for me. And I had been recording my own grandmother telling stories and jokes and recipes for years privately. So when I met Nikki, this woman who had Appalachian memories to share with me, I came prepared and I recorded her. And in a way, it felt very much like stepping back into this role of preserving my grandmother's memories and spirit. So I kind of made a go of it. I spent a couple of collecting trips in Appalachia in North Carolina, in Avery County. I then was in England last year, in the north of England, visiting some friends, and was hopeful that there might be some oral tradition left there as well. So I brought my little recorder with me and I went around. But as I had gone transatlantic and had been collecting these recordings of people, it became obvious that this was something that was still obtainable and still the last wisps of which still reach us today. So I became pretty focused on making this sort of a mission. And we were speaking off air before about the approachability of the archive. And that's something that's really important to me. Folklore shouldn't be this pinned to a cotton swab kind of Boy Scout bug collection art gallery experience. It should be as mouth to ear as it is when it's sort of done within the home. It should be a very personable, approachable form of art or of lifestyle. So when I interact with people that share these memories, I try and keep it very informal and casual. And so by extension, I've tried to make the archive pretty accessible.
When people told you that you can't do this anymore, and it's 100 years ago, that could be done then, but not now. Were you discouraged at all? Were you obviously you followed through, but at the time, were you optimistic that you could find the kinds of stories, poetry, songs that you did discover?
Well, one of the things that was sort of all the rage 100 years ago was what some librarians jokingly call child ballad fever. And Child was a gentleman who documented all of these old English and Scottish ballads in the 19th century. Some of these songs were sung to children. So some people wrongly assume that a child ballad is a children's song. They're not really. Someone usually dies. Some of them are quite gory, these old Scottish songs. And I guess a lot of archivists like Alan Lomax or Helen Flanders 100 years ago had, yeah, child ballad fever. They were on a hunt to find all of these old Scottish songs that had been documented by Child. And so that was sort of the kind of impetus at first. The first recording I made of Nikki, she happened to be singing a child ballad. But there are many songs that are older than some of those ballads and just as important. I had met a woman at a bakery in North Carolina, and she sang me a little bit of a thing called that she thought was called the Chapels of France.
It goes, Orléans, Beaujolais, Notre Dame de Cléry, Vendôme, Vendôme, Orléans, Beaujolais, Notre Dame de Cléry, Vendôme, Vendôme. And if you sing it as a round, it sounds like cathedral bells chiming.
And I had a dilly of a time tracking it down. I wasn't maybe spelling some of the cathedrals that she was singing correctly. I finally got lucky on Google and found it. And it's called, my French is terrible. It's called La Carillon de Vendôme. And it's actually a song from 1420 that was like a children's song about the state of affairs in France. And her mother had learned it in a Catholic school in Cincinnati. So one could assume these nuns have been singing it unbroken these 600 years. So you can definitely find songs older than the child ballad. But if you do visit the archive, I do have a tag set up for anything that is a child ballad, because it's sort of a joke to like all these people 100 years ago that were mostly finding these child ballads. In my experience, I'm not finding as many, but it didn't discourage me. I hope I can say this on air, but I wanted to sort of gently raise a middle finger to the people that were like, you can't find these old songs anymore. And I was like, absolutely, I can. Yeah, I always like a challenge. So when they were like, you can't do this, I was like, you know, watch me.
So you've got recordings from the U.S., states like New York, Connecticut, North Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia. And you mentioned some of the recordings from the UK. How did you actually find the people then who became part of your archive? What was the sort of trail that you were able to follow?
Well, I'll bring Helen Flanders up again because she was really inspiring to me when I started. Helen Flanders had reached out to every Grange in the state of Vermont. She lived in Springfield, Vermont. She was a senator's wife and hung out with like Calvin Coolidge and people like that. So she was a woman of standing, but she took kind of a DIY approach and reached out to state Granges and put advertisements in the newspapers. So some of those are tactics I've used. And sometimes I know people in the folklore world or in the old time music circuit who can say, go speak with this person. So I went to a little farm in West Yorkshire, and that was like a deliberate meeting with this gentleman called Will Noble. Will's actually been over to Danbury to do some dry stone walling because he's so talented at what he does. But he's also got a real knack for singing these old ballads and folk songs. And then some of them have been purely by chance. I was in York, UK, and I was nearing the end of my trip. And I was walking home one evening and I passed this gentleman who actually looked a little like you, Tommy. He had glasses and gray hair and he was wearing this kind of colorful vest. And he just struck me as someone who'd know something neat. But I couldn't really muster up the confidence to just say something. So I got all the way to the end of the block and I said, Derek, what are you saving yourself for? You're here for another week. And I wheeled myself around and I said, hi, I'm looking for old songs and I don't know why, but you look like you might know some. And what ended up happening is that he dashed into his apartment to get this little book of songs that his mother had collected in the West Indies with Edric Connor. And Edric Connor studied folklore, but he was also an actor. He was one of the first African-American actors. And his mother had gone to the West Indies with Edric Connor and done some folklore research. So he brought this book out and he sang me, God, like 6 seconds worth of The Virgin Mary Had a Baby Boy, you know. The Virgin Mary had a baby boy.
And they say that his name was Jesus. Yeah.
He didn't even really remember it, you know, but it was the fact that his mother was the person that had bridged that carol from the Indies into the Cambridge hymnal. And now everyone sings that song. Kids sing that song at camp. So in front of me by happenstance was the son of this woman who'd made this carol incredibly famous and accessible. Sometimes you have to take leaps like that, but generally I like to kind of have a scaffolding and people will kind of point me towards like, you should really speak to this person. There are a lot of games of telephone. I will talk to someone and almost inevitably everyone says, well, you shouldn't ask me, but my friend Bob over there, now he's the guy you should give a call, you know, and Bob will be like, actually, you should talk to Linda. And Linda will say, go talk to Steve. So sometimes it takes a while.
You've also said that your collection, it includes songs, obviously, and poetry, other vocal recordings. You've said it focuses on the non-singer. What is a non-singer?
So that's a little term I coined. I've gotten a little bit of criticism from some academic folks, but most people like that term. It sort of is a dual purpose. It makes the person singing the song feel better about singing it. If I say I'm not looking for like a, you know, Frank Sinatra experience, just sing me what you know and, you know, don't worry about sounding good. Certainly it's a real treat to find someone who does have a beautiful voice, but non-singer, it kind of puts the person at ease because for me, I'm looking for someone ideally who's never been in front of a microphone before. And Nikki, Lena Turbyfil's daughter, completely fit that category. She'd never been on stage. She'd never been in any community plays. She won a Little Miss Shirley Temple contest when she was 3, but that hardly counts. You know, she'd never done anything professionally with music, and yet she could sing me these old beautiful songs. Certainly there are some ballad scholars in the archive, and there are people that are maybe members of a community choir or an old time musician, someone who has sort of performed. But it's my joy and privilege when I encounter someone who's never sung publicly before and they want to be a part of the archive. For instance, and this is another way that I've reached out to people for the archive, I'd put an advertisement, I guess the British would call, in the Dalesman, which is a little magazine in North Yorkshire. I didn't think too much about it, but it was like a letter to the editor. I was like, you know, dear so-and-so, I'm looking for the old songs. If you know anything, please reach out. And that was in November that it went out. And then like 2 months ago, this woman emailed me and she said that her grandfather had sung this old song and she didn't know the name of it. So she called me on WhatsApp and she sang it for me.
Patsy Dooligan, he went to school again. He went to the barber's to get a penny decent shave. He had lovely whiskers on, Galligan whiskers on, and bad that barber he did behave. He jawed and he lathered and he talked and he blathered till he got one side of Patsy's face so nice and clean. Then he went to the other side, the clock he spied, and he said, tomorrow I will finish your shave. For I've worked 8 hours this day, and I think I've earned my pay. Keep your whiskers on till the morning, John, because I won't work half a minute longer. I only remember him singing that. He was a sea captain, and he probably knew more risque songs than that, but anyway, that was the one he used to sing to his children.
She's called Sandra Noble, and the song is called I've Worked 8 Hours This Day. But yeah, Sandra's not a singer. She's not a musician. For me, I don't know, it's this like virgin soil kind of experience where like someone has never done this before, and you know, this might be the only time they're ever singing on record.
Were the people you talked with, the ones who shared these songs, this information with you, were they at all surprised that someone was interested in what they might have thought was something personal or just something in the back of their minds that really represented the past that no one cared about?
Yeah, there's some surprise or there's like some curiosity or what I really get a lot when I say I'm doing this work is especially people closer to my age in their 30s or 20s, they say, wow, I really wish I could do what you're doing. That's so neat. And I go, well, you totally can. Go call your grandmother, you know, and ask her, maybe not even about music, ask her about, you know, the Vietnam War, ask her about her wedding night, ask her about the first time she saw her future husband, ask her about, you know, if she ever made clothes for her kids. You know, there are memories out there that can be shared and maybe not preserved, but an iPhone makes it really easy to just put voice memo on your knee and you'll have that story forever. And that's treasure. So
it's
I
DIY,
get this,
right?
That is DIY folklore, 100%. Yeah. Definitely.
There's a selection I'd like to talk about featured in your archive that offers a different perspective on an old folk standard that I think a lot of people know, Tom Dooley, performed by Yvonne Molly Hicks and Derek Peter.
Well, the Tom Dooley song, the grandpa song, was real. He was with Tom Dooley when they hung it.
Frank Bear was there.
Yes, he was. And he kept telling them Tom Dooley didn't do it. He said, I was with Tom Dooley. Now, this is a story Grandpa told me. And he said, I was with Tom Dooley when she got drowned. So he did not do it. And he was trying to fight them to keep them from hanging Tom Dooley. But they tied him up. And then they hung Tom Dooley.
Yeah.
And Grandpa made the song.
Hang your head, Tom Dooley, hang your head and cry. Kill little Laurie Foster, and now you're bound to die. Met her on the hillside, where you asked her to be my wife. Met her on the hillside, and there I took her life.
But that's not the way Grandpa told it.
Did he sing it a different way?
Yeah.
What did he do?
Hang your head, Tom Dooley, now you're going to die. You didn't kill Laurie Foster because you were with me. That's why Grandpa sang it to me. Yeah.
So Tom Dooley, the old folk song about Tom Dooley paying for the killing of another person. But this conversation suggests that's not what happened exactly. Could you tell us a little bit more about this interaction you had?
These kinds of songs are pretty popular in Appalachia. You have Ellen Smith, Omi Wise, the Knoxville Girl, Frankie and Johnny. Some of these might be familiar to listeners. But Tom Dooley, of course, the Kingston Trio made a lot of 7 inches with that song. And it became a hit. But Yeah, I found that a lot of people in the mountains of North Carolina have the older folks do have some story of like my uncle was there, or I remember the courthouse, or my grandfather swears. So this was one of the funniest stories I'd ever heard about the Tom Dooley saga.
I suppose that maybe chapter and verse, all the specific details of the alternate version may not be accurate, passed down from generation to generation, but I also can imagine it really doesn't matter because it makes for an interesting insight into the way the stories are remembered and told.
Yeah, and it adds to the tapestry of folklore. I mean, you have Jack and the Beanstalk, there's no way that could possibly have been, but so what if Frank was there or not? I mean, it adds to the tapestry of tales and folklore, and it keeps this sort of spirit of invention that I think is so vital to home singing, home taping, home recording, home oral traditioning, and is, a gentle counter to these people that say, all those people are gone. There's no such, those stories don't exist anymore. Well, they totally do. I recorded that in June.
I'm talking with Derek Peter, musician, folklorist based in New England, who has put together what's called the Fieldwork Archive, which is an online archive of folk songs, poetry, memories, interviews from all over the world. It includes an example of a non-singing recording, just as fascinating as the others. It's called Nuts. I like nuts. It's told by Kenneth Roper.
You ever heard the Nuts? I Like Nuts. No, it's not a song, but it was like a childhood thing that we did in ROTC. If somebody called you nuts, you just go, "Nuts? I like nuts. I like peanuts and walnuts and cashews. Cashews make me thirsty, so I drink lots of milk. Milk has vitamin C. C? C is for crazy. I was crazy once. I locked myself in a closet and swallowed the key, and there were ants. Millions and billions of ants. It was nuts. Nuts? I like nuts."
Oh, so it's recursive.
Yeah.
So nuts, I like nuts. Tell us the story of that.
Kenny Roper is a dear friend. He's in his 20s, so he's probably the baby of the archive. I don't know if I have anyone below their 30s, really, other than Kenny. And he and I were actually singing Tom Dooley the way Lena used to sing it, which is, "Hang your head, Tom Dooley, hang your head and cry. Kill little Laurie Foster, and now you're bound to die." And he said, "That reminds me of an old ROTC call that I learned when I was in Reserve Officers Training Corps, and something about, they say that in the army the food is mighty fine. The chicken jumped off the table and started keeping time." So I kind of interviewed him about his ROTC experience, and that sort of came through. It's the song that never ends, so you can just keep looping it forever. So that was kind of a fun treat.
And is that the sort of the significance of it, why you included it? It's a clever little play on words, modern though it may be, that goes on and on and on and on, depending on
Well,
how many
it's
beers
more
you've
about
had,
the
perhaps.
context, I think, than the content sometimes. I often say that these songs are like the banner headlines of someone's life, and then the kind of context of how they came to know them and what they did with them is like the article. You don't sit reading the banner headline all morning, you read the article. So Kenny's story of how he came to know that through, this one officer that he was training with, and this person seemed to be a well of kind of older army sayings and oral tradition, that made it more worthy to include. It's a silly little thing, but again, it's about oral tradition and memory and the fact that anyone can know this stuff.
The stories that are connected with some of the elements that you have on the archive are really fascinating. For example, Sister Frances Smolkowski, I believe her name is, her story documents the immigrant experience in New York City, which is, regardless of when this occurred, it's a very current issue.
"Gee, shy Bethlehem, gee, shy Bethlehem, vessel one of vina. Je panachista, poro gee wasina. Risto shen rogina, sos po porci, Anieli grają królewi, tają pasterze śpiewają, bydlę tak klękają, cuda, cuda ogłaszają.
Were those two separate songs?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about them?
Yeah. The first song, Pushmi Shisi Dostoyenki, is about going to the crib to see the baby Jesus. The second song, Jishai Bethlehem, is about today in Bethlehem, Jesus is born and the Holy Family is together in the stable.
And you learned these in school, you said?
Yeah, we had to. I went to a Polish school. You know, they taught Polish, and we had a choir, Polish choir, and we learned
Jamaica.
Songs. Jamaica, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was the name of the school?
St. Joseph's School in Jamaica, and it was an ethnic parish at that time. It was children of Polish descent were welcome and encouraged, and they taught Polish. And
this is fascinating, I think.
Yeah, I have a friend in Poland who's like grew up totally Polish, and she was like, oh, these are like common, everyone in Poland sings these Christmas carols. But like, then she was like, wow, you know, that you found it in the States, it kind of blows my mind, you know, that you would have this tradition in America. So yeah, I, you know, Sister Frances is of the, oh, I don't want to get it wrong, the Holy Family of Nazareth, the Sisters of the Holy Family of Nazareth in Monroe, and I've known her for 20 years. And I didn't know she could sing, and she's one of the better voices in the archive. I really love her style of singing. You can feel a lot of emotion in there. And again, that's just someone I've known in my daily life that now that I'm doing this archive work kind of formally, you know, has been like, I can add to that. I have a memory. And, you know, that's the big thing is, you know, I've left my contact information on the about page of this website because I do want people to write in like Sandra Noble did with her grandfather's song from the UK. And, you know, I want people reaching out. And if anyone listening does have like a song their grandpa sang all the time or something or some weird song their dad sang by the fire all the time, you know, please be in touch. You know, the website is fieldwork-archive.com, and if you navigate to the about page you can figure out a way to reach me, and that's really what keeps me going is that people do want to kind of connect over these memories and share their stories.
You also include in the archive a statement of responsibility. It says, because of history, here's a quote, some of the recordings in this collection include memories of ancestors that were dated, prejudiced, or outright offensive. Neither Derek Peter nor his informants condone any of these ideas. Nevertheless, they are included here as preserved memories of history and oral tradition. Why is it important to include ideas, values that don't reflect the present day and some may feel should not be replicated or further exposed?
Well, when I do my curatorial work with older recordings and I come across, you know, I don't even need to tell you what word I'm thinking of. I don't include those recordings in work that I'm doing where mm-hmm. I'm bringing old recordings to new light. But when you're dealing with people who have specific memories that they're relating now of attitudes from the past, it's all historical, and whether it's about a knight and a lady or something that's totally arcane and unobtainable today, I mean, there are no knights and ladies in waiting anymore. To me, that's just as arcane and abstract as some of these sort of racial prejudices were. It's just a document of a different era. So it would be erasure and editing for me to not include what people give, because once you hit record and you say, okay, Anna, like, what do you remember? It's out of your hands at that point. What's going to come back to you? And so I've been very careful not to make editorial judgments about what content is netted. At the same time, I can't pretend that I'm really okay with these arcane values and I don't align myself with them. And I do have conversations with the people that I interview. And I just had a woman who told me in Britain, her church group would go around in blackface and sing this song about a boy and his sunflower seeds, using that horrible word. And she was like, and we were so innocent back then. We had no idea what we were doing. And of course, now you can't even say that, you know, and she was horrified at herself, but she still wanted to explain the bizarreness of this situation. The people that are recounting this acknowledge that it's a sensitive topic. You know, you can't pretend these things didn't happen. It's just not fair to the people that they happened to.
Clearly, this is an open-ended project because you're looking for more input from folks who stumble across the Fieldwork Archive. Hopefully, we've pushed some folks in that direction. What's the future for the project? What do you have in mind? Is this really an endless project? It could be, I suppose.
Well, I'll just say this. When Helen Flanders started, because she's sort of my New England icon for folklore, and hopeful fashion icon one day. I don't have any brocade yet, but we're working on it. She got approached by this weird sector called the Vermont Commission on Country Life. And I dearly hope that that's still in existence, because what a strange thing for their Chamber of Commerce to support, this Commission on Country Life. And she'd gotten asked, because she was a woman of means and standing, to do these books on these songs and write down what people might happen to remember. And the long story short is what began as a series of books ended up being like a 40-year career for her of recording. And you can go on Internet Archive through Middlebury College, and she's got thousands of recordings. I mean, this completely took over her life. And not only did the recordings take over her life, but some of the friendships she formed, you know, really influenced the rest of her life. And that's been happening to me, too. So I see this project as endless, certainly.
Derek Peter is a folklorist based in New England, performer, composer, and he has created the Fieldwork Archive. And tell us one more time how people can access that.
Fieldwork, fieldwork-archive.com, derekpiotr.com, or you can just visit the About page on the website. But that's fieldwork-archive.com. Hopefully for many, many years to come, Tom. Thank you so much.
Derek, thank you for your time today and for all of your, if I can say it, DIY folklore work. It's marvelous.
Thank you so much.
And we'd like to close out the segment with Johnny, Poor Johnny. It's performed by Rick Ward. Have an old family song that you still sing? Did you see an amazing show at the old New Haven Coliseum? Share your stories with us. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. And that's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangare, Sophie Camizzi, and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.